It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
As the countdown begins to the 21st century, it's good to know there is still one number you can always count on.
Bond.
Bond.
Can't you just say hello like a normal person?
Renard is behind this.
He will die along with everyone in the city.
We do not negotiate with terrorists.
His only goal is chaos.
I sent 009 to kill Renard. He put a bullet in his head. That bullet's still there.
He feels no pain. He can push himself harder, longer than any normal man.
No hard feelings, Mr. Bond.
It appears that you have been beaten.
Stop!
Don't make this personal.
I can't do that.
I just can't help thinking I'm next.
New model.
In the very latest in interception countermeasures. And 6 beverage cup holders.
I've always tried to teach you 2 things. First, never let them see you bleed.
And the second?
Always have an escape plan.
For the world's greatest secret agent.
You've confused hundreds of these, right?
When the stakes are high.
Yeah, but they're usually standing still.
Life's full of small challenges.
And the danger hits too close to home.
Bomb!
He has M.
By noon tomorrow, you'll feel nothing at all.
I thought it was your job to protect me.
It's not just professional.
Someone's tampered with the bomb!
It's personal.
I have to get it back, or somebody's gonna have my butt.
First things first. I'm gonna find him.
Who's afraid now, Mr. Bond?
I will not miss.
I never miss.
Do you want to put that in English for those of us who don't speak spy?
Why am I suddenly worried I'm not carrying enough insurance?
Your time is up.
The world is not enough.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero, and once again, I am joined by the all-star James Bond crew. And I'm just going to go clockwise with the way they appear on my screen. And first, we have Mr. David Pascarella.
Good to be here again.
Good to have you. Sean Whalen.
You hear me?
You there, Sean? I could hear you, Dave.
Oh, okay.
Kind of lost you there for a second. Pleasure to be here as always.
Pleasure to have you here, Scott Gardner.
Hello.
Hello. Mr. Brian Hughes.
Hi-de-ho.
And last but certainly not least, Mr. Jeffrey Vaughn.
Good evening.
So today we are rapidly approaching the end of the Pierce Brosnan era. And I have to say, as we are approaching the end, my memories have not been lived up to, because I kind of remembered the Brosnan era as being not especially heavy, but just enjoyable in general. And I'm finding I'm just each time I rewatch one of these movies, I'm a little disappointed. It's not quite living up to my memory of it. And today we're looking at The World Is Not Enough from 1999. And as is probably becoming my mantra with regard to these movies, I see a lot of potential here that I feel was just kind of not quite reached. I saw this in the movies, and I don't recall specifically ever seeing it between then and now. This might only be the second time that I watched it. And again, it felt like there was a lot there, but it wasn't cohesive, and it didn't feel like the story narrative, flowed all that well. And I just thought, there's the potential here for greatness, and yet we're not seeing it. I thought we had a good henchman of sorts. I thought we had a good villain. I thought, you know, there was the makings there. But it didn't quite reach what I would hope for. So, as usual, we'll go around the group and see what everybody's initial thoughts are. So we'll go in the same order. Dave, you're up.
I, too, saw this in the movies and realized I hadn't seen it since I went to, you know, see it back in 99. Unfortunately, I was rather disappointed in it. I felt it, I don't know. There were points that, you know, I remembered the plot once I got into it. And I remembered seeing it in the theater, and I must have been very naive, because the first run through of it, Elektra, I didn't realize she was going to be the bad guy. And seeing it through this time, I'm like, oh, this is telegraphed a mile in advance.
Well, you just thought she was Melina from For Your Eyes Only.
I was kind of disappointed.
Yeah. I can't disagree with you there.
And you know, having not seen it in 25 years, when she says that something, you know, she says the not being able to feel, I go, oh yeah, she's the bad, she's the bad guy. How did I miss this the first time around? The other thing that stuck out was the introduction of John Cleese as R, and remembering that whole scene where it's Q's goodbye. That stuck in my mind. But the rest of the picture, it was like, you know, it's like, I know it's a James Bond movie and it's supposed to be a little bit, you know, unbelievable, but it just seemed a lot of unbelievable.
Yeah, okay. I can't disagree with any of that, but I did like, actually, the John Cleese introduction. And
I
it was almost prophetic, since Desmond Llewellyn died shortly thereafter, and, you know, he wouldn't have been around to be in Die Another Day if they hadn't done that, so, you know, worked out okay, but, you know, I guess we'll talk about that as we go along. How about you, Sean?
I saw this one in the theater, too. It's interesting. I find myself... I read a lot of the James Bond novels, and I found, like, my expectations of what I get from a James Bond movie, at least one from this era, and what I get from a novel are very different, you know, as far as depth and story and what I'm getting from them. This era, I was looking very forward to Pierce Brosnan taking over, you know, especially with the fact that it was that delay from when he was supposed to originally take over, at least when I was rumored when he was supposed to take over. I was a big fan of Remington Steele, really anxious to see him take over as Bond. I like him as Bond. So I'm going to admit, his movies, this is being one of them, there's a lot of comfort food to this for me because I like him, which is pretty critical for me. I think what's raised the bar for me is there were certain things that started, and I don't want to go too much into this because we're going to talk about these later, but the Craig films kind of hit a different level of, depth of what I was expecting from Bond films, and it does make me look at some of the earlier movies, not all of them, some of the earlier movies, as being a lot more like what I expect from a typical action film. Like something from Stallone or Schwarzenegger, things like that, which is, I enjoyed this. I found it comfort food and all that, but I am putting it more in that action film category versus what I think of now of what I'm looking for in the action espionage Bond film that I get more from novels and things like that. So enjoyable ride, and I'll share a lot of why as we go further into this.
Okay, next up, Scott.
So I'm just going to preface this with a quick recap of my Bond history here when it comes to Pierce Brosnan, because I can't remember if I've said it in prior episodes or not. But despite considering myself a James Bond fan, I would say a novice James Bond fan, because there's some of them I haven't seen again, since I was a kid, that sort of thing. But I mean, I like James Bond. I've seen the films and everything. Once I got to GoldenEye and Brosnan took over, I remember seeing GoldenEye, but I think it was one of those things where it was like it was on. I wasn't really paying that much of attention to it. I never liked Pierce Brosnan. He's like one of those box office poison guys to me. So I bowed out of the Bond series until Craig came in at Casino Royale. So I had never seen this. We're recording this on a Thursday night. I watched this Monday night, and it's weird because the only expectation, and I say that kind of in air quotes, was that this one, I remember this is the one that people said that sucked, that they really didn't like. And, this one had really been dogged. So I'm probably going to be the contrarian in this one. Hell, I liked it. I liked it a lot. And this actually kind of turned me around on Pierce Brosnan as Bond, because I found a lot of similarities between him and Timothy Dalton with this one. And Dalton's my favorite Bond. And so this one to me felt more, this one felt the most like an outgrowth of the two Dalton films than anything I've seen since the Dalton films. And so I liked it on that level. I liked the romance with I can't remember the characters' names, but the girl that turns out to be the villain, essentially. I thought they had some nice chemistry together, and I liked their moments. That was kind of where it started to win me over. I felt like Brosnan was a little more hard-edged, which is the thing I felt was lacking, and the thing I never thought he would bring to the role, because to me he's cartoonier than Roger Moore. That was my perception of him. And so to see him kind of be a little more of a hard-nosed badass in this one, it won me. And it's a damn good action movie, and which is what I want from my Bond at the end of the day. So I really enjoyed it. And I thought the score was fantastic. David Arnold, I mean, I really enjoyed the one he did. The prior one was his first one, scoring for Bond, but this one here, I felt like, okay, this is, a whole nother level. This is really, this is recognizable David Arnold, and I think he's a great composer anyway. So yeah, I liked it top to bottom. I thought it was really fun. I wish I'd gotten a chance to watch it again to take more notes, because I just got sucked right into it.
Okay. I think you and I are going to disagree on several points, but that's always fun. Brian, what'd you think?
Well, I also saw it when it first came out in the theater and had not seen it until today. I watched it earlier today. Going back to when I first saw it, I actually walked into the theater with a few prejudices, and part of that was because of Pierce Brosnan himself. Before the movie was released, he kind of gave a laundry list of his gripes with what was being done with the James Bond name, in that, every movie had to be bigger and louder and always a world-beating type situation. And somewhere along the way, I had read someone, writing against it. Of course, this is all early internet days, and someone compared it to Mad Libs, a movie by Mad Libs, which is something a lot of James Bond movies would have, because you've got to have your little bit, your cold open, and Bond coming into the office and talking to M and all that. But really, this kind of strayed away from it a little bit in the way it framed its villains. Obviously, we didn't have like an odd job kind of character, where we did have some sidekick, but they were nowhere near as pronounced as you would have, Jaws or any of the other villains that we had in the past. And then seeing the movie, I was just kind of like totally put off by Denise Richards
trying to make her smart. And then totally put off by Sophie Marceau at the beginning, trying to be whatever it is she was, because I always saw her as a more of an elegant woman's woman in the other things that I'd seen her in. So, again, I was thrown off, but I just had Pierce Brosnan talking in the back of my head telling me, you have to dislike this movie. And so, I thought everybody felt the way I did, but that movie made more money than any of the Bond movies up to that day. Apparently, people liked it. I know Roger Ebert liked it. And so I was like, maybe, thinking about it today, I was like, maybe I'll have to rethink that. Watching it today, I liked it better than I did back then, but not that much more.
All right. Jeff, what do you think?
There, if we're going to mention Roger Ebert, I'll use his title of this movie. This is the first Bond movie that I did not see opening day after The Spy Who Loved Me. And it was simply because I worked really late that night and didn't go. I went the next day. I think it is a criminal waste of Sophie Marceau, who is just as beautiful as any woman on the planet at that point, coming out of Braveheart and doing things like that. It's akin to wasting Christopher Walken in View to a Kill. It really is. She is a good actress with a tremendous range, they had a chance to do a little bit of subtlety. And yes, I know I'm talking about a Bond film, and they studiously avoided it. I realize there is a temptation to do, and I'm sorry, I know somebody just mentioned this, to view these through the lens of the Craig films, where you've seen Bond that does hew, obviously in Casino Royale, down to Bond's last line in Casino Royale, coming straight from the novel. Last line when he's talking to M, when he says, the job is over and the bitch is dead. I tend to skew toward the novels, which, Sean, I think you were the one who mentioned that. And I read all the Fleming stuff by the time I was in high school. I read all the Gardner stuff as they were coming out. I didn't always like them, but I loved the efforts in them. I liked the cast in this tremendously, with the exception of Denise Richards. Some seriously great talent represented there. I like Brosnan. Brian and I, our late friend Kevin and I, saw The Fourth Protocol together. And when we came out of that movie, he was so mad that Brosnan wasn't already Bond, because he goes, it would just be the best Bond ever. And of course, I really like GoldenEye, as we discussed. I like it a lot, flaws included. But what I see in this is, okay, the positive, Desmond Llewellyn getting a send off. If you're a Bond fan, you gotta have a soft spot for that. I think it's just human. But the best comparison I heard was in an episode of Psych. And Sean and Gus are talking, and somebody says something about something being unbelievable, and they say, but not as unbelievable as Denise Richards as a nuclear physicist. And I just love that line. Again, all the actors. I mean, think about who you've got actors in this. You got Pierce Brosnan, Sophie Marceau, Robert Carlyle, Robbie Coltrane, Judi Dench, John Cleese, Desmond Llewellyn, and that's pretty freaking great. I did like the soundtrack, so you got that. But that's it. That's. I'll just rehash these points for the rest of the show, because that's where I am.
Okay, very good. So you know what? I'm going to jump right to the thing everybody just lands on with this movie, and I'm going to be a little bit of a devil's advocate, and that's Denise Richards. I hear stories about people who say, oh, let's watch, the Bond films, and then people say, oh, the one with Denise Richards? No, I won't watch that. And for me, to be totally honest, to think that she was such a horrible thing that it would ruin the whole movie just seems to be overstating it a bit. As I was watching it, I was, you know, watching it for today, I was really trying to pay attention to that because I've heard so many things about it. And I didn't really have a strong recollection of it from the first time I saw it. And ultimately, what I came back with was she's a beautiful woman, or at least she was at that time. I don't know what she looks like now. This is 25 years ago. And I didn't think she was that horrible in her presentation. I think the whole thing was saying that she's a nuclear physicist is what ruined it. If they had just made her a worker in the company or in the factory, and she, you know, had a little bit of knowledge just from having been exposed to things, and that's where she was helping Bond, that would have been fine. I can't remember the actress's name from GoldenEye, the Russian actress who was there. Like, if the part had been
Isabella Skorupko.
If the part had been similar to that, okay. Eastern European woman from GoldenEye. If the part had been similar to that, I think it would have been acceptable. The whole thing is just to say, oh, she's a nuclear physicist. Like, that's what ruined it for everybody. If they had just changed that one aspect of her character, I think she was fine. Anybody want to tell me why I'm wrong?
I'm going to disagree.
Good, Brian.
The comparison here is kind of like, you remember on The Simpsons when Homer voiced that cartoon dog that was supposed to be super cool? I mean, it was the episode of The Simpsons. They were trying to make a relevant character out of it. And that's what, you know, everybody was saying about Denise Richards at the time. And that's what Roger Ebert was championing her for. Because in his review, he was just like, she's exactly what, you know, what they wanted her to be, was like 20-something, you know, Generation X go-getter. And that's what she was supposed to be, and she did that. But, you know, when you get down to it, I mean, she is really just a full plastic beast. And yes, I coined that phrase. And that's what I thought of her back then. Now, don't get me wrong. I liked her in Starship Troopers. I liked the character she played, and that. I thought she did a good job playing that. But I think she was playing very close to type when she played that, where here she was going against type. And she wasn't bad, but nobody bought it.
I just felt tempted to say she was just drawn that way when you said she wasn't bad.
I tend to fall into the camp of, there's a lot about this film I really like. The one piece that falls apart for me is Denise Richards on this one. And the only reason why is I like Denise Richards just fine. But during this era, when this film came out, she was a hot actress. I'm not talking about physical appearance or anything like that. The name. I mean, she was a name. So for the Bond film to score Denise Richards as a Bond girl, it adds a whole, you know, not that Bond needs any other flair to it, but she was that kind of actress. The problem I have with her in this film, and it's an area where it kind of hurt, it was like they tried to come up with a role to plop Denise Richards in, give her a typical Bond name, like, you know, Christmas Jones. Yeah. And it felt like it wasn't, when you've got Sophie Marceau, who I actually really liked her as a villain. When we get to talking about her, I'll tell you why. There's a lot that I liked about what she was doing. I felt like, here we get her on screen, and she's doing some really cool things with this character, and we get Denise Richards coming on, and it felt like it brought things down a bit. I don't know that I necessarily feel that it's Denise Richards' fault. I felt like they crafted this role to plop Denise Richards in a movie that, overall, if you ask me, Sean, do you like this film? Yeah, when I do my rewatches of Bond, this isn't when I go, oh my God, I got to go watch World Is Not Enough. I don't feel that way. I really enjoy watching this one. But I think it's the difference between it being great and it falls apart when she's in there. Because I feel like these scenes start to bring things down a bit because it almost feels like it's a different film during some of those sequences for me. That's just personally. But
that's a very good observation.
See, I think as written, Sophie Marceau's Electra King is supposed to be a very layered character, and I do think they fail a little bit in that it is kind of predictable that she's going to be on the other side of things. But I do think she's supposed to be much more sophisticated, whereas despite the fact that Christmas Jones is supposed to be a nuclear physicist, she is supposed to be what you see is what you get. That, you know, there is no underlying layer that's different. She's not a deep character, and, you know, many Bond women aren't. But I think that's okay if you don't make her a nuclear physicist.
Yeah, that was the problem for me. It'd be like casting Harpo Marx as the president.
Don't get me started.
No, I mean, yes. I mean the generic, I wasn't speaking of any particular president. I'm just saying, if you watch the movie Superman and Harpo Marx played the president, you'd be, that's a bridge too far.
Especially since he was dead by the time they made it. But that's besides the point. But yeah, I mean, I'm going to agree with a lot of what Jeff said about Sophie Marceau. Is one of the things I liked about her as a Bond woman is I thought she was exceptionally beautiful, but not in the traditional Bond woman way. She's more of a like a classic beauty, and I thought that was really, you know, I thought that lent to that sophistication that I'm saying was there. Again, a little bit predictable that she was going to turn. You know, I can only think she was playing Patty Hearst at the time. But I liked the way they presented Renard as the villain, but it turned out he was the henchman. So I thought that was kind of cool because it did, you know, even with her turn, I thought she was going to turn and then just be subservient to him. I didn't realize it was the other way around. So that definitely played with my expectations a bit. I liked him as a villain, though. I liked him as a henchman. In some ways, he felt like the classic henchman, you know, the from Goldfinger and Live and Let Die. You know, the whole story that he had a bullet in his head that kept him from feeling pain. The only thing about that was when he picked up like a burning a red hot stone. I don't care whether you feel pain or not. It's still going to burn up your hand, yeah. And you're going to have. Not, you know, it's going to burn the muscle right through the muscles, and you're not going to have use of that hand anymore, whether you feel it or not. So that was the only thing to me that, like, they were pushing the envelope a little on that. But I would have liked to have seen a more open battle between him and Bond, similar to what we got between Bond and Oddjob at the end of Goldfinger.
I think they were going by Darkman rules on nerve issues. Because if he saw Darkman all the damage, he probably should have taken.
Well, Liam Neeson, yeah. You can't hurt.
No.
He will find you.
So, what did you guys think of Robert Carlyle in the movie?
Well, he's an actor with tremendous range, and has shown that in both on television and in film, and can do pretty much whatever is called for in the situation. He can be a character that's just about entirely noble. He can be a reformed badass. He can be the evil guy, and everything in there. There's nothing wrong with him that wasn't in the script.
Agreed. I would agree with that. You know what he kept, when I saw him, my mind kept going to an older Robert Blake. I kept seeing that in my head.
I'll be honest, I found him the least compelling out of any Bond villain I had seen, really. I mean, he was just a guy that couldn't feel pain, and it just, my movie watching life had kind of slipped around all the movies he's in, even, you know, the Train Spotting and things like that. I had not seen those. I really did not recognize him until I saw the TV series Once Upon a Time, and then all of a sudden, oh, hey, that's the guy. But, he just wasn't imposing or impressive. Even his way of talking as a character made him sound more like very thuggish to me. The way he spoke compared to Bond or Zukovsky or Sophie Marceau, Elektra, I'll leave Christmas Jones out of it.
And in a way, Brian, that's telegraphing that he's going to turn into the henchman and not be the lead villain. If you look at him on, you mentioned, we mentioned Once Upon a Time, I had had a recent dose of Stargate Universe. You know, I had done a couple rewatches because I was writing the comic book of it. And just basically very unlikable character on that show. As they peel back the onion by the end of the second season, you realize there's reasons the way he is. He's still a jerk, but there's reasons the way he is. And I thought it took a real commitment to performance to do that, to play that kind of character, which just makes me madder at the screenplay in this one, because the guy's got the talent.
I wanted to see more of him. So, I mean, I liked him. So I'm not in the camp of that I didn't like him. I felt like there was like another scene I would have loved to have had with him.
Underutilized. Sure.
Because I felt like somebody's mentioned before, and I apologize, that it was more telegraphed that he was going to kind of become the thug of the story. And I really didn't view him as – it came very quickly that I didn't view him as the villain when I started to kind of figure what was going on. But I liked him, and I felt like I would have liked another scene before we got kind of that reveal where he got a chance to show just how evil he was, because the sequences where he was being intimidating, all that, he was selling it. I mean, I was into the fact that this guy's dangerous and deadly, and I wanted to see a little bit more from him. But I liked the character, so I'm a fan of the character. I would have liked more of the feeling of him being the villain before I started to realize that it was really Elektra King that I should be looking at, who I quite liked, and talk about her when we get to it.
I was kind of impressed with his acting, because my only experience is Once Upon a Time, and I kept trying to say, oh, am I going to see Rumpelstiltskin? And he really doesn't seem anything. He really seems like a different character. I think he's a great actor.
But again, I think, you know, I'm just reiterating what basically Sean and Jeff said, but I think he had the chops to play the part. He had the backstory to feel intimidating. They just needed to give him a little bit more focus and a little bit more screen time. You know, I mentioned the odd job fight at the end of Goldfinger. But in addition to that, I think they needed something earlier, and I don't remember which of you said it, but something earlier just to kind of show a level of intimidation by his character that would make us anxious to see that showdown with Bond, because you're already saying to yourself, how's Bond going to beat this guy?
Yeah, I think one thing I wanted to say about that, and this is an admission, I've read nothing about the making of this film. Unlike most of the Bond films, I've read nothing about this, and probably deliberately. And so I don't know if they filmed it and it got cut, or something like that, because we all seem to say there's something lacking there. Even those of us that like this film say that there's something lacking with this character there. Did they do more and we just didn't see it? I don't know.
Here's a piece.
I think it's a case of... Go ahead.
Here's a piece.
It's a case of where the...
Go ahead, Ryan.
Where the writer was in Grant Morrison mode, and he's like, let me show everybody just how smart I am in getting all this together for them to go at the end. Oh, that's what it was. And they had so many writers in there. Even the director's wife took a stab at the script, and someone else came in and cleaned everything up. And it was too many cooks spoiling the broth, taking out some of the meat. So I don't think it even wound up on the cutting room floor. I just think it got left out of the script.
I almost felt like the film painted itself into a little trap with the sub at the end. And the reason why I'm saying that, it fits the whole story and everything. So it's something I think is cool. And the part where the sub starts sinking and starts doing the nosedive down to the bottom, really liked that. I mean, the claustrophobia and that kind of stuff, that worked for me. The problem with that is the claustrophobia also traps our lead characters, our lead villains, on where to have a fight. So they were fighting in that compressed space, and you got this guy who you can do some damage to, that you could really do a cool fight with him and Bond at the end, and they're in this confined space where there is no room to move, no room to throw things at each other, no room to really show how intimidating this guy is. And I would have liked to see that knockdown drag out between the two at the end that I think would have been cool with what he had going on with the brain thing.
It's a very contradictory thing that I'm saying, because I liked the whole sinking sub thing and the fact that it was the vehicle for what they were doing with what they stole and all of that. I thought that part was cool, but it set a trap for a villain that I think deserved the fight that I really wanted to see, for the fact that he's supposed to be this impervious guy, and I think he and Bond could have had a really cool knockdown drag out.
And I think the initial, what we were talking about just before, about having an initial scene to set him up, was a victim of they told us, they didn't show us. Because they had the exposition scene where they talk about how the bullet did this to him, and they didn't bother showing it to us, they just told us. And I think that was a mistake.
Yeah, the thing for me, that I thought they could have done it so much better than having him get rammed by that rod, was that this is a guy that doesn't feel anything. And it would have been funny to just kind of have him have the original Jaws ending, where he's sitting there fighting Bond and then doesn't realize why he's getting weaker by the minute. And that's because he's been stabbed and whatever, hit in the back so many times, he doesn't realize that he's dying even quicker. But they didn't even play on that. Didn't utilize that at all as a weakness of his. You could have walked up to that guy from behind and stabbed him 10 times and he wouldn't even know it.
Yeah, and that's something you could have played with, definitely, because you could have had him stabbed, but they didn't hit any vital organs, so he just keeps going.
Yeah.
Right.
That whole plutonium rod at the end reminded me of a giant ink cartridge for a Parker pen.
Yeah.
The pen is mightier than the sword, apparently.
So, I want to talk a little bit about
some of the puns for this. That would have been, that might have worked in a Bond film.
I want to talk a little bit about Pierce Brosnan as Bond, because I do think we have a little bit of a difference of opinion, but maybe not as major as I think. GoldenEye, I really enjoyed, and I thought this was going to be the start of a real nice Bond era. And now, Tomorrow Never Dies, The World Is Not Enough, both kind of just left me feeling like, again, that the screenplay let me down a little bit. Because I do think that Brosnan carries off the shaken, not stirred attitude really well, as far as I was concerned. I think he looks the part. I think he plays it okay, but I think he's been the victim of some shoddy scripting. And I do think that the appreciation of his era as Bond would be looked on much more kindly if the scripts had been stronger. And I do think, you know, it was mentioned earlier that, you know, the contrast between that and what they went to with Daniel Craig and the script writing and the storylines, you know, is just so stark that, that hurts his legacy as well.
Paul, I think you're right on that. And, you know, I'm a fan particularly of GoldenEye, and I liked Tomorrow Never Dies. It has one of the greater later Bond film lines in it from Jonathan Pryce. There's no news like bad news. And highly competent Bond woman in Michelle Yeoh, which had a lot of appeal to me. Probably the most competent. And building on, you know, as I saw it, the legacy from Barbara Bach and Spy Who Loved Me. But that's the thing I've said all along. Like, the minute I saw Casino Royale, I thought, why couldn't they have given a script of this quality to Pierce Brosnan? Because I've seen him in other stuff with good scripts. He can do what's necessary. He loved playing Bond. He made that very clear. But I think that backs up your statement just very powerfully.
A very good friend of mine, I've watched Bond films with since I was a kid, and this era in particular was when every film we'd go to, he started groaning at certain scenes, and it was the over-the-top nature of some of the stunts with this particular era. I'm of the camp, when it comes to Pierce Brosnan, I really like Pierce Brosnan, and so, I mean, I'll put that caveat on my comments here, because if you're not as much of a Pierce Brosnan fan, this mileage is probably going to not carry for you. There were certain sequences, because it was him, and he was, I like his Bond, I like his swagger, I like he carries it. He added something to scenes that otherwise would not have been as interesting to me.
I liked his chemistry with Sophie Marceau. I liked the fact that he didn't immediately jump into the relationship with her. I liked the fact that he was trying, which is, we know, is hard for Bond. He was trying to kind of keep that line initially. And when we get to talking about her, I'll talk about what it was about her that I found was compelling about that whole sequence. But I liked him throughout this film. He carried even some of the scenes with Denise Richards that I didn't like as much. And it sounds like I hate her. I just felt like I truly think she deserved more than what she got when she got to that point. You know, as far as if you're going to cast somebody in this film, you need to give them something a little bit more. This is a film I like. And a lot of that involves Pierce Brosnan and Elektra King in particular. Those sequences are really good. I liked his interplay with M, because that's a roller coaster relationship in this, because M is the one, usually it's Bond that is way too close to an event, and then M has to pull him back. They've kind of had a role reversal in this one. Not saying that Bond didn't do well, kind of getting a little too close to the lady in this situation. We saw that with Elektra King. But M was very close to this situation because of the personal nature of the death in the beginning of Elektra's father. And I really liked how Bond had that reverse interplay with her. And I find those two interacting off each other as just really a cool relationship in this. So those are the pieces I liked, actually. So Pierce Brosnan was kind of a saving grace for me in this film. That's my two cents.
But, you know, I got to say that Brosnan's performance was really, really good in light of all the stuff that I had read. He didn't have that look like he was bored or upset or just the paycheck. He was doing his all as he always did. And so I enjoyed his performance for what it was. I'll leave it at that.
I felt the involvement of M, you know, having read a lot of the books and watch the old movies, there's always an impression that the security around M kind of rivals like the prime minister or the president. And, you know, thinking back to You Only Live Twice, Tanaka makes a reference to, you know, the way he travels underground. M has a similar system. It seems like that they wouldn't have allowed her to get into a situation where she's going to get grabbed.
Yeah, I agree with that. I really like her as M, though. I have to say, I thought she really just, you know, I liked Bernard Lee early on, but, you know, since then, I think she's been by far the best thing.
It's frankly her security people that weren't very good.
I like that you actually got to see her do something in this one, because, you know, you can, and maybe this is extremely sexist, but when it's a male, you can kind of imagine that they've worked their way up. Like maybe they did Bond's job at one point and they've worked their way up and now they're the guy in charge. With her, I never got the impression that she had been an agent that worked her way up, that she was more of like a bureaucrat or something that got
eventually. She was an accountant.
She was an accountant, as they said, in GoldenEye.
Yeah.
But I really liked in this that you saw that may be that, you know, she came from some other thing and had never been a field agent or whatever, but that didn't mean that she was just, you know, a cream puff or that she was a damsel in distress. She had brains and she was figuring out her own way, you know, out of the situation. I really enjoyed that. I liked it. And it didn't feel like some forced girl power thing. It was very natural that this is a very smart woman that they have completely underestimated. And I liked that a lot because I like her. I think she's a phenomenal actress and I really like her in this particular role. And I like the moments, you know, starting with, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe it was GoldenEye, where she came in and told Bond that, you know, she thought he was a dinosaur and all that, yet right from that movie, you see that she also has a grudging respect for him, and their relationship kind of grows from there. And this is where I really felt like, okay, they may not come right out and say it, but you can tell they care for each other, you know, on some level. And there's that, not only that mutual respect, but there's a mutual affection of sorts. And I really like the part where he confronts her, and the very first thing she says once the room is cleared is, you know, I will not tolerate insubordination. But then from there, it's more personal than it is professional between them. And I like moments like that. That really was one of the things that, you know, that really won me over with this one. And, you know, like I say, I find myself in the weird position of feeling like I'm defending Pierce Brosnan after years of really, really being down on the guy. But he totally won me over in this. This was the first one where I really felt like, damn, I was wrong. You know, he can do it. And I enjoyed that. And a lot of it, you know, goes to Sean's point. I liked his chemistry with, you know, with the femme fatale. It took me probably a lot longer than it should have to realize that, okay, there's something more going on with her. And, you know, I wasn't stunned when she was revealed to be the bad guy, but it was a little shocking only from a story aspect of like, oh, this is where you're going to go with that. I was a little disappointed because I liked the two of them together. I liked their dynamic, but it also made the ending where he has to kill her that much more impactful, because then it has that tragic love element. And I'm always a sucker for that sort of thing. You know, I'm a romantic at heart, I guess. So it worked for me on a lot of levels.
Scott, I want to agree with what you said about the chemistry with Judi Dench and Pierce Brosnan. The first time we meet them, obviously it's adversarial. Then, as you said, grudging respect. There's a great line in the opening sequence at the weapons market in Tomorrow Never Dies, where the Admiral, Jeffrey Palmer, says, what's he doing? And she says, your job. Mm-hmm. You know, clearly defending her guy, you know, whatever she thinks of his methods and whatever else. You know, I think that was like a really strong through line through their films together.
Yeah. I thought good writing in this was when the tracking card was activated, that Bond immediately knew it was M. I thought that was a cool bit. I mean, in a film where I'm saying there's like uneven writing in this one, that was a sequence where I'm like, that pacing was perfect.
Yeah.
Because in the whole room, the first person that immediately knew that it was M, because the tracking card, you know, you start running through your head, who would have access to one of those? M. She, of course, would have found a way to activate it, not knowing what she did or anything like that. I thought the clock bit was kind of cool. I thought that bit was really well done.
Watching it this time, I did have a question about that, because she, you know, the clock was sitting on the chair, and with whatever she had in her hand, she knocked it over. Why couldn't she use that to pull the chair to bring the clock to her instead of waiting for the next morning for one of the henchmen to do it? It seemed like she didn't try hard enough. But maybe if I'd been there, maybe I would have seen it differently. It just didn't look like it looked like she could have still done something.
The bit I found amusing was, you watch all these old movies where they're always trying to jimmy a door open with a credit card, and he's got a credit card that's a lockpick device sponsored by Visa, no less.
Quality product placement. You know, I mentioned earlier, I talked about Sophie Marceau and kind of what I thought of her, and I think I didn't give everybody a chance to give their thoughts. In fact, I've heard, when we talk about her. So if anybody has any points to add, I thought she was terrific. I really liked her character. I liked the development. I did think I was able to see that, you know, that she was going to be turning. And I think I was meant to see that. I don't think it's, I outsmarted the director somehow. I think, you know, the story was meant for you to realize she was going to turn before she did. But just, you know, anybody who has any thoughts on her, just feel free to throw them in now.
I liked her. I thought she was good. She played a good part. She's a very attractive woman. I liked her.
I thought she was stunning. Stunning. I'm not just the visual look, because the visual look was all there. She definitely had an exotic look about her. I think it hurt Denise Richards in this one, because I think she was so compelling that when then you're supposed to shift over and root for him to be with Christmas Jones, I was completely still captivated on the relationship, like the sadness of that relationship not working out. One of the things that I really liked about her was we got to see multiple elements of range from her, where she goes into this sequence where she's first introduced and she's saddened by the death of her father. You know, we get to see that whole piece in there, feeling kind of this revenge vibe on whoever went after her dad. But then we got to see like that claustrophobia sequence where she is now having flashbacks to when she was kidnapped. What I still don't know to this day, and multiple rewatches in that, was she really going through that, or was she just selling the captivity that she was in? Because she's this double agent. So, you know, she actually was the one that turned Renaud. So in that sequence, was she just being this really evil villain that played her part really well, or was she really terrified in that moment? I think that's way cool that I was, you know, having that whole sequence there. When they show up at the pipeline and there's that whole turmoil going on at the pipeline and she takes charge, there were sequences where she was stunning because of, you could see why Bond would not just like the visual beauty, but could see this as a partner potentially. And that's something you don't always get from a Bond girl. You don't always get the idea that this is somebody that like can challenge Bond. Really has that, and that's where the chemistry between the two is really working for me. I'm like, I kind of get his draw, and I also kind of get where maybe he didn't want to see what was starting to appear in front of him. And that's something that it's an edge we may all feel a little bit differently on this one. I think there were certain things happening in front of Bond that you kind of get why, I get why maybe he didn't want to see it as soon as he was seeing some of the little clues that were going on there. He calls her out on it, and she starts explaining it away and tries to turn it around on him, and you see how she just has that skill set that would have eventually turned Renaud. And I like that part. I thought she was one of my favorite parts of this film.
You know, while I don't like it, I think you made really excellent points. You know, I don't think that it's strong enough to save the movie, but I agree with her. They show you some character elements there that maybe with a better script, because like I'll keep saying the same thing. There's nothing with Denise Richards. There's nothing wrong with the talent in this film. It is close to epic.
Mm-hmm.
That's the scene with Zukovsky where she basically gives him the money. Is that enough to tip Bond off? I mean, should that be the final straw that says to him, there's more here than he knows going on?
Well, I think that is the point when he starts to think that, yes.
Yeah. But is he too much enamored for the red flag to really signal it's a red flag?
I think that my gut instinct is that it's all the other stuff that he's managed to explain in his own head. Given like Sean said, the track record and everything there, and Scott, you mentioned that you're a sucker for the ill-fated romance in the thing, and I think one of the things about Bond, there's a lot of ill-fated romance. There's a lot of ill-fated romance there, and Bond may be this machine, but he is underneath it all human, and there are cumulative costs, including the loss, you know, starting with the loss of his wife. Even though Bond girls died before her, they were just Bond girls,
right?
But you saw how quickly he got close to her, how he tried to not do this at first. There's elements here of a freaking phenomenal movie, and that may be why I get so down on this movie, because the elements there's so many great elements in this that if they could have just pulled back from some of the Bond silliness and just pulled back from the temptation, and I get their temptation, of casting Denise Richards and giving her the typical Bond girl kind of name and all that kind of stuff like that. They had gone off, largely gone off of formula. Think about what we've all described here. We've described the guy we thought was the main villain being the henchman. We've the girl we thought was the Bond girl being the main villain. That's freaking brilliant. And again, that is probably why I get so harsh about this, is because they made so many great leaps. Couldn't they have just gone a little bit further?
I noticed something this time around, and it came to the ending with her. One of the things, they have the final confrontation between Bond and her. And she is not, but she's so convinced of her confidence in her, just her ability to woo everyone over, that Bond's just not going to be able to harm her in that sequence. I actually liked the epic ending with her. I liked the cold, harsh Bond ending. He told her not to do it, and she ignored him, and he reacted accordingly. The problem with it, and it's going to seem like a strange thing to say it was a problem, because I'm saying it was a pretty epic moment. That was at the ending between the villain and the hero in the story. Everything afterwards this time around felt to me like the epilogue. And good epilogue. I mean, I wanted to see where that was going to go, but the epic moment happened. He killed the villain. And we already knew that her boyfriend was going to die. I mean, he already had the, you know, issue with that. He's just trying to stop a bomb at this point. I know it seems like a weird thing. You know, it's a bomb that can blow up so much. But for me, it was after that bullet went in there, it was, I don't know what else is going to top that. Because it's something for Brosnan's Bond, that kind of harshness, especially with a female villain, was something that was very edgy for that particular era. And that struck me.
Sean, that's right. You remember in For Your Eyes Only, where Roger Moore charges up those steps, stands in front of the car, shoots, car spins to the cliff, he tosses the pin in and kicks it over the cliff.
Mm-hmm.
This was Brosnan's moment of that.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. So as you can see, there's so many things I like in this that's why I get so mad at it, because it's so freaking close.
Yeah. Well, that's the Bond from the books.
Yeah.
He's a brutal killer.
Yeah. Yeah, and tearing his own heart out.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I do find that as we're talking about it, it's easy to focus on the negatives. They jump out at you a little bit more. The positives are a little bit more subtle. And then, you know, there are definitely positives in this movie. This, you know, and I feel like I've pointed out negatives to the point where it's made, you know, it may sound like I'm thinking, oh, this movie sucked. No, this movie did not suck. It was a James Bond movie. I enjoy all of them. They're all my children. But you know, when you see things...
I pretty much to everybody so far, I've said to back up your point. But here's to back up that point. I want to say, first off, I think the diversity of opinion in this panel... brings out a lot of stuff. Everybody's very respectful and all that, but we have some very fundamentally different opinions about this film and about many of them, if not most. And that's pretty cool. I also think that what you said is really true about it's harder to talk about the good points, particularly when you hate a movie. And I hate this movie. And I hate this movie for the reasons I said, which is it's so freaking close. And yet unwaveringly chooses the wrong thing at the critical moment. But don't you? It's just so freaking great to have this kind of talk about a film that you don't like, because I've sat here for the bulk of the time extolling some of the things I love about it. I think it's a phenomenal discussion. Sorry if I'm patting ourselves on the back, but here we go.
Well, I'm going to give you another point of disagreement, and I think I may be the only one on this one who's going to have a negative. Is when we talked about Tomorrow Never Dies, I talked about the score feeling exceptionally generic, except for the John Barry moments, which I didn't think were all well placed. I kind of felt like this one put the John Barry moments in the right place, but the rest of the score just kind of escaped me, didn't do anything for me.
You know, it's sort of hard to argue if, because that's your personal opinion, if it doesn't do anything for you. I think it worked. I don't think much of it was very intrusive at all. I thought most of it was okay. I'd rather go for understated than intrusive.
Maybe there's a couple moments. Yes, totally.
Maybe there's a couple moments that are a little awkward, but I basically liked it. Didn't love the theme, you know.
Yeah, Scott, you were pretty high on the score. What did you know? What's your opinion for that?
Well, I mean, I have not acquired a copy of it yet, so I haven't had a chance to listen to it separate from the film. But paying attention to it while I was watching the movie, I mean, I was well impressed with it. But, you know, I'm a pretty easy mark when it comes to that because I really, really like David Arnold. I think he's a phenomenal composer. I really liked his score for the prior film, and I ended up getting a copy of that either right before or right after we recorded our episode talking about it. And I've been listening to it pretty frequently and really enjoy that as well. But that one, you know, as we discussed in our review of that movie, that one was kind of like the Bond's greatest hits. Whereas I felt this was an actual score for this movie, if you know what I mean. Yes, it used the familiar Bond themes and everything, but it was more scored to the movie, you know, scored to the specific film. That's how it felt. And I liked it in that aspect. I thought it was a really good action movie score. And so I'd really like to hear it separate from the film. I just haven't had a chance to get a copy of it yet. But that's one of the things I really noticed with this one was I watched this. I have Dave, I think, has the same set that I do. The DVD set, the one that's in the like the binder. So I watched it on DVD. So while the video quality was a little lower for me because, of course, you know, I'm watching it huge projected, I was well impressed that for DVD and for 5.1 surround, it blew me away. I mean, it sounded phenomenal. So, I mean, a great, great sound mix that I was impressed, you know, really was separated well. So all the channels got really good play and everything. They really used the space effectively, but not just for sound effects and all of that, but the score really fit that space well, you know, very well, you know, in that regard too. And that's not really been the case for the Bonds up to this point. So this was the first one where I really felt like it was more of a modern movie, if you know what I mean, because now it's the technology, you know, this is 1999. We're getting into, you know, the CGI era. We're getting into that era where movies were really starting to get big and bombastic and louder and more, you know, really using surround sound and that sort of thing. And I think those were a lot of the elements that worked for me as well. I continue to be a little shocked that so many of you guys are really down on this one, because it makes me wonder what you look for in a Bond movie. Because to me, this kind of reminds me of like Punisher Warzone. You know, I see so many people down on that movie, and I just scratch my head and go, it's a freaking Punisher movie. What are you wanting from it? He kills the shit out of bad guys. This is the same thing for Bond for me. There's only a few things I really need. I need beautiful women. I need him killing the shit out of some bad guys. I need some gadgets, and I need some big explosions. This movie gave me all that shit, so I'm perfectly happy. It was a really good Bond movie as far, and you know, all this talk about story, I mean, it's a James Bond movie. How complicated is the story supposed to be?
Well, Scott, I'll give you my answer to that, because I think you very succinctly framed what you're looking for from it. I started out with the movies first. I've mentioned it, but I saw Goldfinger at a drive-in with my folks when my quintessential review was Car All Broken. I have seen all of them at the theater since Spy Love Me. And this was, like I mentioned, this was the first one I didn't see opening day after that. What I'm looking for has evolved over time as I've read the novels, as I've seen how other novelists have handled other characters. We can't, you know, it can't exist in a perpetual vacuum. They ran into that, whether I agree with it or not, with them having the apparent death of Bond in the last film.
What?
Oh, thank you.
Spoilers, everyone.
And you know, the way I look at it is, I want all the stuff you said, but I want it through the filter of the books. The books, and you know, I'm hardly the first person to say the books are better. The books are different. And there's some of them are better and some of them aren't. I mean, Spy Who Loved Me literally has only the title. You know? And it's one of my favorite films. But we've seen what happens when you have to keep going bigger is better. You go from Spy Who Loved Me, which was epic, to Moonraker, which is not. And anyhow, it's just I talk about this way, way more than I should in life, because I've been passionate about it for like about 150 years. And it is, to me, that's why I know that Brosnan's getting a little bit of a bad rap, because we all can't help but view it through the filter of the Craig movies.
I'll give you a
not
a point.
Me.
Yeah, Dave hasn't seen the Craig movies yet.
That's right.
But you should see them. When Kevin McClory got the rights to do Never Say Never Again.
Yes.
Oh God.
There was talk that, because basically it was, the story was Thunderball, remaking Thunderball.
Yeah.
And there was talk about Bond being such a formulaic thing that they could keep remaking Thunderball over and over and over again with McClory's license to do so, and have it be different movies every time.
Well,
what that is exactly what I don't want from a Bond film. I don't want them just to give me the same exact thing over and over again and just add new stunts in. I want them to give me a creative villain, a creative confrontation, a plot that makes some sort of sense as to what they're trying to do. There's things that I'm going to look for that aren't going to be just doing it over and over and over again. So I didn't think this was doing it over and over and over again, but I did feel like some of the script writing was by the numbers, if that makes any sense.
I think that's the most succinct thing any of us have said. Seriously, it was. They did a bunch of different stuff. I think we all agree that they did some different things in this, but there's a bit of paint by the numbers there, and that's in the screenplay, which is what I...
Mad Libs.
It's exactly it.
I can't agree with that.
But you're coming, Scott, you're coming from the perspective of maybe you've just been convinced that Brosnan isn't so bad.
Well, so, it's not just that. I mean, the love story element really worked for me in this one, because typically, you know, with the Bond films, it's, you know, love him and leave him. You know, he may be madly in love or seeming like he's madly in love, but you know damn well this woman's not going to even be mentioned in the next movie that comes along.
Right.
And every once in a while with Bond, we get a Bond girl that sticks. You know, she may not be in the next movie, but you can tell she got under his skin, in his heart, whatever you want to say. You know, his wife. And I had shades of, like, Vespa that would come along in the Craig films with this. And I think that's one of the elements I liked most with this, was that he was resistant with this. You could tell he was attracted to her, and not just physically, but he resisted and resisted and resisted. But then once he gave in, he really fell. I feel like he fell for her.
Yes.
And I think it really tore him up the way things end in this. And I like that. And that's not formulaic. That's something that we've only gotten in a couple of the Bond films. More often, I feel like the women are completely disposable for Bond, you know? And that for me was the dichotomy between the villainess in this and the Denise Richards character. I feel like you guys are a little too harsh on her, because only for the aspect. Now, I don't know the woman. I only knew her by name. I don't think I'd ever seen anything with her in it. So the only thing I knew was that, again, I had heard all the rumors that she was absolutely terrible and everything. Is she great? No. But she's only hired for two big reasons, and, you know, she fulfilled those just fine. She's eye candy, and that's it. And the whole nuclear physicist thing didn't bother me, because, you know, having had, you know, leaders that were full of themselves, or managers that were full of themselves and overreached their title, I just looked at her and said, you're not the nuclear physicist. You're the nuclear physicist assistant. And that's how I brain canon that. And so it didn't bother me. So she's just there for titillation, yeah. And it works in that regard.
She reminds me of a character. There was a movie, I looked it up. It was from 1985. It was called Moving Violations, with these people. They have to take, you know, a driving class. And, like, right. The love interest, he's like a dopey character. And the guy's like, oh, she's no rocket scientist. And he's, so what do you do for a living? Oh, I work for NASA. I'm a rocket scientist. I feel that's where they got her from.
Yeah.
The one thing that I remember hearing out back in the day was, and it was kind of like this running joke, that she was the reason they didn't special effects Oscar. Because if you guys didn't know, the thing in Turkey couldn't actually be done, so they had to do a lot of blue green screen work to make Turkish scenes look right. But she lost in the Oscar because there was no bounce in her assets.
You know, when they went up to check out the pipeline and she jumps out of the... They jump out and ski down the mountain. Well, I kept thinking of, you think the president of ExxonMobil does this too?
It was funny. I was going to compare this to one of the Roger Moore films, because you were asking a good question before. What do you want from a Bond film? Actually, this is what I want from a Bond film. I like this film. You are very much in the same camp of this film. I like this film. But if I compare this to Tomorrow Never Dies, which I really liked, the last Brosnan film, you have the relationship with Terry Hatcher of this, in that one. You build from her death to the relationship with Michelle Yeoh and what was going on there. There's kind of like this pacing and flow. What happened with this one with Denise Richards, and it's I hate bashing her on this because I don't dislike her, but if you're comparing the relationships between the two, it was like after the death of Elektra, I think there was not enough script development of this relationship with Christmas where I'm like now invested in Bond winding up with her in the end. And I felt like that's where it took a little bit of a turn. And I look for that kind of build in the Bond films. And I'm saying this as somebody who, I like this film.
But see, that's the thing though, is I don't think she was just his thing on the rebound. He's just hitting that and then moving. There's no relationship there.
Right.
You know what I mean?
That's how it is in most of these movies, though. That's the staple of it.
Yeah.
Jill St. John and Diamonds Are Forever. What great relationship did they have? She had a pulse.
She's not the thing that pulls... The only thing that pulls me out of this movie, and I hate to say it because I love the guy, John Cleese pulls me completely. I was like, John Cleese? I think I had heard that he was in one of these, and I just
He's
had
in
kind
two of
forgotten.
Them.
Yeah.
Is he?
He's in the next one also.
I love John Cleese, but he's John Cleese. He's not... You can't sell me on him being a character anymore. He's just one of those people you see and you go, well, that's that person. And it just...
That's a pretty fair point. I think the only thing I've bought him other than him being John Cleese or one of John Cleese's own characters in was when he was the sheriff in Silverado.
Oh, yeah. No, I thought he was great in that. And you know what? I have just the opposite situation. 95% of what I've seen John Cleese in was skit comedies. So I'm used to him playing a different character every time. So I know it's John Cleese and I recognize him and all, but I can take, you know, I can kind of ride with him no matter who he's playing.
I have to share John Cleese anecdote because I only have one. I was sitting eating breakfast on a Saturday morning in New York City. And John Cleese and a small entourage came walking by the restaurant we were sitting in. We were in window seats. And he comes walking by. And that's about, I don't know, must be 8 years ago now. And I'm still dejected that he wasn't doing a silly walk. Just utterly disappointed.
So before we rate this, does anybody have any other points they want to make?
Nobody has really talked about Robbie Coltrane as Zukovsky in this. And, you know, the thing was is that I thought he played his role a little bit different than he did in Goldeneye, but I was so disappointed when they killed him.
Yeah.
It seemed like a waste, didn't it?
It did, yeah. It seemed like a huge waste of the character.
I liked what he did when he died, though.
Mm-hmm.
I liked how he had the choice in that moment to take revenge on Elektra and recognize that he's got that one shot and he took it to free bond, which was an interesting sort of play. I actually liked that part. I would have liked to see more of him. So I'm with you. I didn't want to see him die. But I thought that was a good choice.
And I agree. Again, more, you mentioned the phrase more development.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind a noble sacrifice. We could do with more movies with that kind of stuff, quite honestly,
mm-hmm.
including Bond films. But it was a little too bang, 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 you know?
Yeah, it didn't feel like it was given the respect that it should have gotten.
On the nosy.
You know, I liked his character. He was fun and you know, in his own way, noble. So I would have liked to have seen just a little bit more respect given to it. But again, I feel like I've spent an hour now ragging on this movie. And it's a movie that I did like. You know why? Because it's a James Bond movie. There is no James Bond movie that I don't like. And Dave will tell you, we reviewed Never Say Never Again together. And I still gave it a Jaws 3 because it was James Bond and it was Sean Connery and you know, I like them all.
Can I put it in perspective here? I think that, well, number one, all of us here love James Bond movies. I mean, they're some of the more favorite movies for us that we're always going to remember all our lives. That being said, bad James Bond is still better than good Root Canal. It's... You're probably still going to like it. If it comes on TV, you're probably still going to watch it and go, wow, you know, I don't remember it being that way. Because, again, me watching today, I'm like, yeah, I don't remember it being as good as it turned out to be for me today, where I guess I kind of went in with a chip before.
Yeah.
But it's 25 years later. I'm an older person.
Ultimately.
Different ideas.
Ultimately. I'm going to come down as a high Jaws 3 on this. It's very watchable.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
Let's talk about Q. The goodbye of Q.
Always give yourself an escape plan.
Yeah.
I mean, you could see how old he was. And when I heard that he passed, I thought, you know, he had some sort of illness that was making him give up the part. And then I found out he died in a car crash.
Yep.
Which surprised
me. That legitimately kind of choked me up, that scene, because I had just read that this was his last time. So seeing him and just it's almost eerie, the his exit from this film because of what happened to him a short time later. It's a little unsettling, but it genuinely gave me a lump in my throat. I was like, aw, you know what?
did he plan not to come back for any more?
Yeah, that was that.
He was gonna have a shorter cameo in the next movie, but obviously that had to be written out.
Because it really seems like he's saying goodbye,
right?
That he does care about Bond.
Yeah,
I
think Desmond Llewellyn did have some sort of, I don't know if it was terminal, but some sort of illness that was taking him down at that time. So I don't think he was going to be able to do much acting at all. So I think he was coming out of it. But again, died in a car crash. Go figure.
David made a good point there, too, about him showing that he really cares about Bond. I actually really like Brosnan in that scene, too. Because of the fact that when Q's like alluding to the fact that he's going to be going off to the sunset, Bond, you know, expresses through his own dialogue that, like, not now, though, right? You know, and I really liked how he played that scene. It added to the piece that you were talking about, David, that there is more between these two over the years of poking each other and things like that. I really liked that sequence.
You can point to the scenes in License to Kill when he comes and helps Bond, when Bond is a rogue agent, too, to show that there's more of a relationship, more of a positive relationship between them than what is always in the dialogue. So, yeah, I can't imagine a Bond fan who doesn't love Desmond Llewellyn.
There's an interview on one of these extras where they're interviewing Desmond. You know, he says, and when he got the job, he's like, oh, well, you know, I love Bond, right? He's this great super agent. He said, oh, no, you hate him. He has no respect for your equipment. You know, he's wrecking everything.
And he's the angry father is what he is.
Right.
He still loves him.
That's why
but he wants him to show more respect.
Goodbye. Yeah.
So, okay, now that said, having redisposed of the monster, as I said, I'm going to give it a high Jaws 3. I think if they had fixed some of the script problems, it would be a solid Jaws 2. And I think if they had fixed all of the script problems, it might even be a Jaws. This movie had a lot of potential. So my disappointment in the movie is just that I think it could have been even better than it is. Not that it was bad. And I think sometimes on this show, Jaws 3 almost gets the... you know, the rap that, oh, that's saying you didn't like a movie. No, Jaws 3 is saying it's a good movie, it was fine, I enjoyed it, but it's just not at that upper level. So that's where I'm putting it. So if we continue in the same order we went before, I believe, Dave, you were second.
Okay. This movie has some weaknesses. It's the script. It has problems with the script that needed to be tweaked. I don't blame any of the actors. I thought what they were given to work with, they were all great. I like Pierce Brosnan. He's one of my favorite Bonds. I would almost maybe rate him number two, to be honest with you. I like him that much. But there's some tweaks that needed to be made with the casting. And what they were given to work with, you know, I'm not blaming the actors. I give it a very, very high Jaws 3 as well.
Okay, Sean?
I struggled with this one a lot. My journey with this one for the purpose of this particular podcast has been unique because we did GoldenEye. So when we did GoldenEye, I watched GoldenEye, went to Tomorrow Never Dies, went to World Is Not Enough. Not because I had to, and it actually comes back to Ryan made an interesting comment before that. I thought your root canal comment was an interesting one, because I think there's a point of that. There's certain Bond films where I don't go through that range, you know. But in this case, I didn't have to do it. I wanted to. I wanted to watch this again. This film is one of those, Paul, which you said earlier about this one could be, it has like some of the pieces, parts to make it a Jaws one. I agree. It actually could, if with the script being corrected and making some changes, this movie has elements that could make it that. I teeter-totter between Jaws 3 and Jaws 2 heavily on this one because there's some flaws in this one that keep this one from being the upper echelon. Reason why it's a Jaws 2 for me, it's everything I said about the flaws, I totally stand behind. the edge is I wanted to watch this again. I wanted to watch it for this particular episode. This is a film that is in my rotation. It's on my shorter list rotation. There's something about this film, in spite of the flaws that I totally agree with, I really like. And and the villain, I think, is one of the key pieces of this. Elektra King, there's something about her and the relationship with Bond that I just really, really enjoy about this film. And it keeps me coming back to it. So for me, it's a very low Jaws 2 for me, because of the fact that I feel that this film has so much potential to be so much more than it is because of the parts that I like so much about it. I actually wish it was one of those Bonds where I'm saying this is Jaws 1, because I feel like those elements are there. So I'm giving it a low Jaws 2 because I feel this film should be much more than it is.
Okay, Scott, you're up.
I thoroughly enjoyed the movie. I don't know what else to say about it. I really enjoyed the love story element and the twist with that and everything. I thought that she was a really worthy both love interest and adversary for Bond. I thought it had some great action sequences. I particularly liked the bat boat at the beginning of the movie. I thought it was really cool. Good score, great sound mix. Just some incredible action sequences. I mean, it gave me what I look for in a Bond movie as far as that goes. And I really liked the end battle, the claustrophobic nature of the sinking sub and all that. I thought that was pretty cool. And I see Sean's point about, that final boss battle being in that confined space, but I kind of liked that. I thought that was kind of an interesting take and an interesting way to go. I actually had to look up to see which was first, this or Star Trek Nemesis, because I found it very interesting that both the villain in this, or the henchman rather, in this and Shinzon die very similarly in those movies. So I was trying to figure out which one was first. So, but yeah, I'm going to go a solid Jaws 2. I enjoy the hell out of it. Now, again, maybe it was a little bit of new car syndrome, new car smell, because this was my first time seeing it, so maybe in subsequent watches it'll go down a bit, but for now I have to say this is definitely my favorite of the Brosnan, Pierce Brosnan ones that we've watched so far, because I thought GoldenEye was okay and the one prior to this was it was all right, but this one I genuinely was all in. I was like, damn, that was a good movie when I was done with it. Yeah, I liked it. Jaws 2.
Fair enough. Brian?
Things I love and things I hate. And I'll talk about the things that I really love. Number one, I really love that the whole opening segment, and basically you don't get to the credits until basically the end of the first reel. It's that long. All right? I love the boat that Bond was in. I love the fact the other boat was pretty much indestructible even after he tore chunks off of it. I had to laugh at that. It gave me kind of a Sheriff Pepper laugh, I love the BMW. There was the Z8 that he was driving, and I loved how it got destroyed. I just saw it using that tree cutter as a villain tool is really, really good. There's a lot of things in it to love. Robert Carlyle, though, was not one of those things to me in that whether he was the villain, the henchman, he didn't bring me any dread. I didn't fear him like you would other villains. So, that really hurt it for me in a big way. That being said, it's still such a watchable movie. I also loved Robbie Coltrane's Colonel Sanders outfit that was beige rather than white. That was funny. Even wore the little Dudley type hat. That was good. But for a rating, I'll give it a high Jaws 3.
Okay, Jeff.
Did I put Paul to sleep?
You're next.
All right. We'll end it on a happy note. No, not really. I think that everything that's wrong with this movie is the responsibility of the writer, the producers, and the directors. everything that's wrong with this movie started before this movie was ever made. Maybe as it was made. Don't know about how all the casting went. And like I said, I did not do any reading about the making of this movie. I don't even blame Denise Richards for how unbelievable she is. You were getting her. That was your stupid decision. I get mad about how close this movie got to greatness. The story elements are there. This could be one of those movies that we're talking about as one of the best all-time Bond movies because of their willingness to stray from the formula. The poignancy of the last Desmond Llewellyn scenes. And the epic, and I used that word before and I mean it, with the overwhelming majority of the cast, the quality of their craft. But that's what makes me the maddest about this. So I'd say a low Jaws 3D.
Fair enough. So that's going to do it for The World Is Not Enough. We're going to be back together again to look at Die Another Day, and I'll give you a little sneak preview that when I first saw Die Another Day in the movies, despite the fact that the world seems to hate that movie, I loved it. So we'll see. I'll give it another viewing for the purposes of this show and see where I come. But we're going to see. If Pierce Brosnan ends on such a down note as the world would have us think. In the meanwhile, thank you everybody for coming on with us, and thank you everybody for listening. We'll see you next time.
Oh, if this movie had J.W. Pepp at the beginning, it would have been great.
If only.
If only.
What are you, boy? Some kind of doomsday machine?